Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Susan Lingville spends a lot of time sitting on hillsides, binoculars in hand, looking down on the coulees of southern Alberta. For 6 years, she's watched white-tailed deer run from coyotes on the hunt, while mule deer will fight to the death. And somewhere in that chain of events fits the lowly ground squirrel. And when he was working on the oil rigs, Quinn Holtby got tired of all the spillage and waste on drill sites, so he invented new technology to prevent pollution and save money. He calls it the catch can system. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. If you've ever spent time in southern Alberta, you know there is no exaggeration in the term bald prairie. It's that fact that brought Susan Lingville to the McIntyre Ranch near Lethbridge. What better place to watch the interaction between deer and coyotes, and let's not forget the ground squirrels. After hearing about her fascinating research into animal behavior, you'll simply have to agree that coyotes really can be a farmer's friend. Susan Lingville earned her PhD through Cambridge University, and she's now a postdoctoral researcher with the Department of Psychology and Neuroscience at the University of Lethbridge.
Yeah, it's all open prairie, primarily fescue grassland, and that's why I came to this area. I looked for field sites from as far north as whitetails and mule deer occur together down to Arizona, and the McIntyre was clearly, once I got there and see mule deer posing for pictures as you drive into the ranch, and whitetails ambling across the open prairie, I knew it was a fantastic place for an observational study.
How do you do your observations?
Well, the main thing is to find very good vantage places. So often I'll sit up high looking down low, or sit low looking up on the slope, and you want to have a really wide view. And so once I find a good vantage point, I'll sit in place and try to find coyotes before they begin a deer hunt. So once they begin a deer hunt, hopefully I've picked a good place to sit, and I can see them as they walk into the nooks and crannies of the hills. And because there are no trees in this area, you can pretty much see them through their entire hunt while they're hunting deer.
Now, when they go hunting, do they hunt by themselves or do they go in groups?
Well, when they hunt deer, they go in groups. And in the mid-90s, when I started working at the McIntyre, the groups were about 4 to 5 coyotes for a deer hunt. So basically, during the winter, they'll be out on their own hunting voles. It's a small mouse-sized animal, hunting voles in the morning, and then they'll pack up around 11 o'clock, and then they'll head out on a hunt right around noon. And I was under the preconception, as probably most people are, that they'd hunt early and late, so it was only quite late in the day that I realized that most of the hunts were really occurring around noon.
Now, why noon?
From spring to fall, they hunt early and late. And I think that's because the ground squirrels are out during the middle of the day, because the ground squirrels are definitely their preferred prey. But once the ground squirrels hibernate, they start to rely on deer then. So maybe because the ground squirrels aren't out is why they're hunting more during midday, during the wintertime.
What's it like when they go after the deer?
When they go on a hunt, they travel single file, and there's a certain leader, and they just walk along at sort of a fast walk, and they'll pass by a lot of groups of deer, but the conditions have to be just right to find a deer that they find suitable to attack. And when they do, at that point, one coyote will probably run towards that animal or walk in slowly to kind of surprise it. My focus has been on behavioral differences between whitetails and mule deer, so it gets hard to say exactly what it's like because the deer behave so differently that the coyotes have to adjust their behavior depending on whether they're catching a whitetail or a mule deer.
Well, so they know which deer they're going after.
Yeah, they pretty much go into either whitetail habitats or mule deer habitats during a hunt. And even if they're hunting an area with mule deer and they pass by a whitetail, they mostly ignore those.
So then I guess we have to look at what's different between the mule deer and the whitetails, because they're in different places, aren't they?
The mule deer tend to use more rugged topography, and they're not mountain goats or bighorn sheep by any means, but they do use hills or steeper rolling terrain and just a little steeper, more rugged areas than whitetails. And the whitetails are found on more gently rolling terrain, and there's a certain amount of overlap, though. At the McIntyre, I'd have the whitetails on the very gentle rolling areas, the mule deer on the steeper slopes, and both species kind of on the lower gentle slopes. And the basic differences between the behavior of the deer is that the whitetails rely primarily on flight to avoid being captured. So if a coyote's walking up to a whitetail, it can take off, and the whitetail's fast enough to outrun a coyote. But the mule deer, it's completely different. First of all, they're not fast enough to outrun coyotes. They're much slower than whitetails if they use their jumping gait, which is called the stot, or even if they gallop. And instead of fleeing, they tend to bunch together in a group, I call it bunching, and then a few females will go out to defend that group. Or if a fawn or adult is attacked, some females will intervene to defend that animal. And it seems that the whitetails, because they're so fast, can actually occur in these gentle areas, which is where the coyotes mostly occur. But the mule deer overall do more poorly than whitetails during winter, and they seem to have to use some of the more rugged habitats to avoid coyotes.
When the coyotes then are going after the deer, which do they prefer to go after? Which are they most likely to take after?
Okay, well, actually, that's a very good question. Because there's more whitetails, there were higher numbers of whitetails in winter, and the whitetails occurred with more overlap, as you pointed out, with the coyotes, you would expect the coyotes to take after the whitetails. But it's completely different in winter. It's the mule deer that they selectively hunt in winter, and in spite of having less overlap with them. And because of the behavioral difference between the two species of deer, their mule deer are actually more vulnerable in winter. And I think I can explain it a little more clearly for any listeners. The whitetails are fast enough that they can outrun the coyotes with, and so that ability seems to allow them to coexist with the coyotes. And the mule deer, if they flee, they're extremely vulnerable. I mean, just 50 to 100%, you know, of the time it'll result in a kill. But if they stand their ground and fight, they're actually as successful as whitetails. But the problem is they don't always stand their ground, so sometimes they do the wrong thing, right? So overall, mule deer encountered by coyotes do more poorly in wintertime. So instead of staying right where the coyotes are, they end up going into the hills. And what I found out is that the mule deer that occur low on slopes or in gentle terrain are the ones that are selectively attacked and killed. And so the coyotes are actually selectively removing mule deer from those gentle habitats, and they don't similarly remove whitetails from those gentle habitats. And the second thing that keeps species apart is when whitetails are present, even if a whitetail and mule deer are in the same group, they will tend to move apart. The mule deer will move upslope and the whitetails down.
Now, how did the coyotes know what to do if they're dealing with the different species of deer in different habitats? Do they act differently when they're going after different species?
In the summertime, when I see pups, coyote pups, encounter mule deer for the first time, I think they learn very quickly. This is all very subjective, but I think they learn very quickly. You see them follow a parent out from the den. They run into a mule deer who puts her fur out and comes after them, and they head right home to the den. The whitetails just don't respond in that same way. So I think the coyotes learn early on in life the difference between the deer. But the mule deer, even though coyotes go after mule deer more often in winter, the mule deer are much more dangerous because they fight. And what they do is they use that jumping gait again, the stot, to hop around and stay with their forelegs oriented to the coyote. And so they're trying to hit the coyote with the forelimbs. And the coyote tries to get around behind the mule deer so it can lunge at the back end, which isn't going to attack it. They don't kick out from behind the way, say, a horse does. And these battles go on for hours, even if you have a single fawn in summer. I've seen fawns continue to kind of pivot around in this way, and the coyote will get a hold of the fawn for 10 minutes, and then the fawn will be able to kick it off, and the next day they might still be battling in this way. The mule deer, it's hard to exaggerate how tough of a fighter a mule deer can be. But the white...
You're talking about fawns, though. Those are babies.
Well, fawns by winter are 5 to 6 months old, but still it's 30 kilograms, maybe 60, 70 pounds. They're not that big, and I've seen this even with wounded ones, so it's even a fairly vulnerable animal. In the summer, when fawns are, say, 2 weeks old or even 2 months old, it's different. They're not able to fight at that time by any means, but they still will dodge coyotes successfully. And I've seen a fawn whose mother wasn't quite right close by dodge lunges by, say, two different coyotes. The coyotes will lunge at it, and the fawn will hop aside. And when they're only a week old, they just sort of hop and stand there. But the coyotes seem to lose their balance enough to give the time so that the next coyote lunges and the fawn hops aside. Like, that's very effective. But sooner or later, they have to have the defense of some other animals. So by winter, The fawns will defend themselves if they're alone, but if there's females here, there, the females will do the defense and the fawns will stay back.
How does that differ from the way the white-tailed deer respond?
Well, the coyotes will often just stalk in on a white tail, and they have to get very close to have a good chance of catching them. But pretty much when they grab hold of a white tail, they seem to go down without much of a fight by comparison. I haven't seen any of the same kind of defense by white tails that you see in mule deer.
What stage is your research at now?
Well, I've been working with the two species of deer for a long time, and I've more shifted my focus to what was going on in summer, which is quite a different situation, and it's really interesting. And I've just wrapped up 6 summers of watching coyotes hunt whitetails and mule deer. And the reason I say it's different is that, first of all, it's the whitetails are more vulnerable in summer than mule deer, where the mule deer, I told you earlier, are more vulnerable in winter. And what seems to be the case is that even though the mule deer doesn't do as well in winter, then you're wondering, well, why on earth do they use this strategy if it, you know, if the whitetails do better, why don't the mule deer, why did they ever lose their ability to flee and develop this aggressive strategy? Well, it turns out the aggression of the mule deer is extremely effective in summer to protect those young fawns, because even a whitetail fawn is way too small to outrun a coyote in summer. So I'm finding that aggressive defense is very effective in the summertime. So I've wrapped up that research, and I really just trying to get that information out.
Is there a difference between the way the whitetail and the mule deer actually deal with their young?
Basically, the mule deer females kind of band together in nurseries that raise fawns close together, and the whitetails pretty much leave their fawns in hiding and take off until the next nursing period. So the mule deer are in these nurseries that are pretty much ready to take an aggressive defense against their predators, where the whitetails still are relying a little more on concealment in the summer.
What are you going to be doing now with your research?
Well, my immediate goal is to analyze and write up all the data I've collected over the last 6 summers. And I'm also trying to do some longer-term monitoring of the deer and coyote populations at the McIntyre. And in particular, the ground squirrels are really essential to this whole story. That's the main prey that coyotes eat, as long as they're above ground. And it seems that the amount of predation going on the deer really depends on the number of ground squirrels. So I'm trying to establish a long-term monitoring program where I can really test how the abundance of alternative prey, such as ground squirrels in particular, but also voles, affects the amount of predation on deer in summer and winter.
Will this have any effect on, say, conservation efforts or even how farmers and ranchers react to coyotes? Because quite often they get shot.
Yeah, they do. In terms of conservation, I guess I'd mention a few things. The results having to do with that habitat segregation, by finding that coyotes selectively remove mule deer from gentle terrain and that mule deer can find safety in more rugged terrain, it points out that even though these whitetails and mule deer seem to use very similar habitats for food, they need very different habitats to be able to withstand predators. And we tend to have increasing number of predators overall and lowering number of ungulates, especially in other provinces and a lot of states where the trapping of coyotes isn't quite as common. And so we need to ensure that we don't, say, fill up some rugged terrain when we build a dam or cut off access. It would be easily to sort of unintentionally cut off their access to certain rugged terrain when we're building fences or roads. But on the other hand, ground squirrels are, this is quite a different management slant, but the ground squirrels are the main prey for coyotes in southern Alberta. And when you see people going out and shooting all the coyotes, when you know that they like ground squirrels even less, you kind of wonder, because I tend to think of a coyote would be sort of a farmer's best friend in many cases, because they will help control the ground squirrel population.
So it really goes round in a circle, doesn't it?
Well, the ground squirrel, I would guess, must be the most essential animal in this sort of prairie ecosystem, because really all the predators that are here, the hawks, some of the eagles, coyotes, are relying on ground squirrels. So the presence of ground squirrels can have an enormous effect on other wildlife, for example, the deer as well as the predators. If the ground squirrels aren't there, the coyotes will turn to the deer.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dr. Susan Lingle is a postdoctoral researcher with the Department of Psychology and Neuroscience at the University of Lethbridge. Her current research is funded in part by the Alberta Conservation Association. Part of Alberta's oilfield legacy is a long line of tinkers and inventors, people who have worked the rigs and come up with better ways to do things. Quinn Holtby of Catchcan Limited is one of those ingenious fellows. I met him recently at the Greenhouse Gas Technology Conference in Calgary. He was there promoting his zero-spill technology, which he believes will save the oil industry $100 million.
Well, we believe that it's possible to catch all the spillage related to drilling and service rigs before it gets on the ground. In fact, we have a system that we call the zero spill system. It assembles without tools, can be installed in any drilling rig. In fact, we're in 32 countries at this time. Getting back to the Canadian market, it can be installed in 4 hours and it will give you a zero spill result when drilling holes on sensitive areas in Alberta. In fact, I think all of Alberta is sensitive, and it addresses the issues that farmers have with certain oil companies saying they aren't going to spill, and they end up spilling, and then they come back and clean up, and it makes it difficult for people in the industry to make sure that all the spillage has been cleaned up. And it's a great way to minimize these orphaned well situations that we have right now.
So what exactly do you do? What is the technology?
Very simple, actually. What we've done is we've designed it so you don't require any tools to assemble. It's using an over-center latch technology, put the pieces up of equipment up underneath the drill floor, clamp it together, clamp, clamp, clamp. In fact, first time you put this in, if you've had a hand that has never done this before, you can have it in and out in 5 minutes. And most traditional methods of steel pans literally take you as many as 2 days, 3 days to assemble, hoist up into place, very dangerous. Neat thing about our products, too, are they're made of a polymer that's used in the aircraft industry, and that's why we are in so many different countries, is because of the temperature range that our product can handle, such as in Alaska, the temperatures can range 40 to 50 below. You go down to Mexico, and the drilling fluid itself is coming out of the well at 214 degrees Fahrenheit, so your product has to be able to withstand the temperature range of minus 40 to plus 50 degrees Celsius. And we've designed the products, the polymers, to do that. And because they're only weigh 10% the weight of a comparable steel unit, they're lightweight. You can assemble them in minutes and without tools. They're very durable. In fact, our life expectancy on some of our tools, even though they're made out of plastic, are 7 to 10 years.
So show me now. You've got this set up here, this demonstration. How does it actually work?
In the old days, typically, we used to use plastic bags, coats, gunny sacks, you name it, whatever we could come up with to wrap around drill pipe to control that discharge, because if we didn't, we'd end up getting it in our eyes and everywhere in your body, and when it was 40 below, you instantly froze. So it was no fun at all.
Now, this is water or a mixture of stuff that's coming up from down the well?
It's water. It can be diesel fuel invert. It can be all kinds of different drilling fluids that are toxic not only to the environment but to humans. And by controlling and redirecting it, capturing it underneath the drilling rig, keeps it completely off the personnel as well, puts it back into the mud tanks where it belongs.
So how do you do that?
The old technology was the 270-pound mud can that only fit drill pipe. So all the other applications, such as making connections, pulling wet drill collars, test tubes, core barrels, etc. like that, you had massive amounts of spillage of drilling fluid all over the drilling rig, and it was not uncommon to see 5 to 6 feet of ice built up under the drilling rig that you had to thaw out in order to move the drilling rig. So now you spent money on using your boiler full blast to melt all this ice, and all it had to do was really control and redirect and capture the drilling fluid, keep it off the ground. So by using and employing what we call the zero spill system, the first part of the system is what we call a Kelly can. Weighs 27 pounds, installs by one person, and fits your entire drill string from 2 inch to 7.5 inch. So when you get into a situation where you know you're going to be spilling, you just clamp this on, controls, and redirects it. Second part of the system is called a catch can. It fits underneath the drilling rig and captures the drilling fluid and puts it back into the top of the flow nipple, out the flow line, back into your mud tanks. So that way, on average, if you spill 15 gallons of drilling fluid per connection and you make 10 connections a day, some rigs make 100, 110 connections a day, 5-minute connections. So by capturing that 15 gallons of drilling fluid per connection, and assuming that's worth $1 a gallon, and if you make 10 connections a day, you've just saved $150. Not only that, because you've spilled the other 150 gallons of drilling fluid, you must rebuild that stock, so you've actually saved $300. So it doesn't take long to pay for our system. In fact, most systems are paid for in 60 days or less. That's the cheapest drilling fluid that you can get. And most expensive drilling fluids can be in excess of $500 for a cubic meter of it, and it's not uncommon to spill 3 cubic meters per trip.
Who came up with this idea?
An old roughneck. I did, actually.
What made you stop and think, I've got to do something here, and how did you come up with that idea?
I've seen a lot of friends injured. I was injured on the drilling rig, so some of the safety issues that we wanted to address were a long-term goal. We've been working on this process for around 20 years, coming up with the final designs and stuff like that. And also the spillage and the necessity of having to use boilers to thaw out 5 feet of ice, when in reality all we had to do was come up with a system to clamp onto the bottom of the drilling rig and recircle this drilling fluid. And it's in the Alberta guidelines: reduce, reuse, recycle, recover. I say them a little differently because recover should be the last part of the scenario, and if you're using your system properly, there is no recover, because all your drilling fluids have gone back into your mud tanks where they belong for recirculation and reuse. So addressing the 4 R's, that's a key. Why did I do it? Because I set a goal 20 years ago to come back and change the industry. Make it better, make it safer, make it easier for the people working on the drilling rigs, make it smarter.
You're at a conference that's dealing with greenhouse gas emissions. How does your product fit into that?
This seminar basically deals with greenhouse gas emissions that are produced from gas plants and wellheads and stuff like that. But also the other area that creates greenhouse gas emissions is having to clean up these large messes on drill sites, because you have heavy-duty machinery coming in there to dig up the ground. You have these dirt burners, thermal units that burn the dirt at certain high temperatures to burn the hydrocarbons out of it. And really, there's no need for that. If you capture it and recycle it, put it back into your system, you don't need all this heavy machinery out there digging up the ground and missing this part and missing that part and basically wasting money, wasting resources. If you capture it, recycle it, there's minimal mess in the end. And that's on a drilling rig side. On service rig sides, if you spill drilling fluid and frac fluid and completion fluids and stuff like that on the well site, over the period of the lifetime of the well, that's could be as much as 20, 25 years. And typically when we come out to a new site with where the rig is just moved off and they now have a casing bowl and they're going to put a well head and bring the rig into production or the well into production, then you'll see that the casing bowl is usually sticking out of the ground 2 feet. 25 years later, the casing bowl is 4 feet underground. So how much gravel have I dumped onto that site and how much spillage has actually occurred? Well, you get to clean up that whole mess by being proactive and putting a zero spill system on your service rig and on your wellheads. Then there's no need to haul in all that gravel, and then that eliminates the problem of abandoned wells where people are careless with their spillage, etc., over those 25 years, and now you've got this huge, massive cleanup bill at the end of the well when it doesn't have to happen.
What is your market?
We're being widely accepted in over 32 countries, such as Mexico, Venezuela, the Middle East. In fact, we have commitments from certain oil companies in those areas, Pemex and PDVSA, that they seriously need a solution to some of their concerns. And our packages, zero spill systems, offer exactly what they're looking for.
That was Quinn Holtby, inventor and entrepreneur. His company is Catch Can Limited. Of course, as the Corb Lund Band puts it, there's always room to celebrate our God-given brawn and brain when it comes to getting work done.
Hey! You got a real long reach in the derrick when he leans. He's been all around the world on the big old rigs with the welders and the trucks on the black gold rush and the diesel burning cat motors growling in the mud. You better hire him on, he's the roughest neck around. He got the power in his hand to pull the dragons from the ground, yeah. It's 98 above, and he's working through it all, cause baby, this is what he loves. Drives 150 miles, make sure his kids are doing fine, and he sees them when he can, but he's married to his iron. You better hire him on, he's the roughest neck around. He got the power in his hands, he's pulling dragons from the ground, yeah. He's a good hand to have on, and he's throwing on the tongue, spinning a chain and sliding high side all night long, and he's dripping in his pipe, and he torques it good and tight, and you gotta figure it, he's got his mud weight right. You better hire him on, cause he's better than the rest. He got the power in his hands and the dragons in his chest, yeah. Pull the dragons from the ground. Yeah, you better hire him on, cause he's better than the rest. He got the power in his heart and the dragons in his chest, yeah.
That was The Roughest Neck Around. You can win a copy of this new CD by the Corb Lund Band by entering this week's contest at innovationalberta.com. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. You can listen to past programs on our website at innovationalberta.com. The program is sponsored by Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, True North Energy, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, the University of Lethbridge, the Alberta Research Council, the Alberta Conservation Association, Health Sciences Association of Alberta, the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, and the National Institute for Nanotechnology. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.